All right, everybody. Welcome to this episode of our show, True Data Ops. I'm your host, Kent Graziano, the Data Warrior. In each episode, we're going to bring you a podcast discussing the world of data ops with people that are making data ops what it is today. Now, be sure to look up and subscribe to the DataOps.live YouTube channel, because that's where you're going to find all the recordings from past episodes. If you missed any of our prior episodes, now is your chance to get caught up. Better yet, you can go to truedataops.org and subscribe to the podcast. Now, my guest today is a Snowflake data superhero, international speaker, author, senior data architect. He's actually an independent data architecture consultant. He's been advising clients and leading delivery of data solutions for over 26 years. This includes Europe, North America, Middle East clients in a variety of industries like healthcare, financial services, and telecoms. So joining me today live from Dublin, Ireland is my buddy, Dan Gallivan. Welcome to the show, Dan. We got a little bit of a lag here, but so for those that don't know about you, you want to give us a little of your background there in data management and a bit about your career.
Of course, Kent, and do keep me posted if the sound is coming and going. So yeah, I think I'll cover it in three areas very briefly. So I'm a consultant, I'm independent, and I'm Irish. Now, the last bit's the most important part, but I'll cover the two areas briefly first, okay? So yeah, I'm a consultant. I actually graduated in 1999 with a degree in IT and German. And that was when, you know, people barely knew what Google was. That was when Facebook did not exist, YouTube was not a thing. You know, all these things, Instagram, and most importantly, Kent, people at the time knew how to survive without a cell phone. So, but basically, you may be asking, what does IT have to do with German? And it actually opened, that qualification actually opened a lot of doors for me. I got an opportunity, so I'm Irish, I'm from Ireland, born and bred, but I got a chance to work in Germany. I was due to go for 6 months. I loved it so much. I stayed 6 years, but it taught me a lot about consulting. Particularly as a consultant, you need to understand your client's needs. And I had to do two things. Listen closely to understand that, but also listen closely to understand what was being spoken, because you can learn a language academically, but it's only when you're out of the classroom, out in the world, that you really learn it. So but that was really honing my skills as a consultant. And as I said, I'm independent, which means I'm vendor agnostic. Sometimes I work with vendors, but it's really about my client's requirements. And because sometimes clients need an independent voice. And that what this independence gives me is the chance to call things as I see them, right? So unequivocally, I can, you know, call it the lay of the land as I see it. And did I mention that I'm Irish, right? Right. I'm a straight shooter, Kent. I'm a straight shooter. So what that means is, as a consultant, and this is something I learned while working in Germany, you have to not only listen, but know how to ask clear and concise questions. And in addition to that, you know, in Ireland, we have a lot of multinationals hosted here, pharma, social media, financial services. And I'm originally from the sunny southeast. I'm going to wrap up on this one very quickly, Kent. I'm originally from the sunny southeast in Ireland. Baywatch, Kent Hasselhoff, and Pamela Anderson. Yeah, it's nothing like it. We have nice sandy beaches. Yeah, so that's it in a nutshell.
Now, as you and I've discussed, you know, this season in our podcast, we've been like taking a little step back to think about what's happened in the world of true data ops and how things have evolved. Because a lot of things have changed in the last couple of years. And I mean, you and I have been at this for a while. You know, we've you know, worked in the Snowflake world together and had a lot of conversations. So, you know, you're out there, you're being an architect, a consultant, and, you know, practitioner in the field, helping, you know, a lot of customers, as you said, quite a few different fields, different industries, trying to take advantage of their data for a while now. Yeah. So from your perspective, what is data ops and how important is it to, in today's complicated data landscape?
Sure. Thanks, Kent. Well, where to start? I mean, one of the things I see is a development and of the data product mindset. So, and it's not always called that. It's not always referred to as, yeah, now we're going to have a data product mindset. But it's things like being more aware of governance, particularly around data, particularly around the shift left. I mean, Kent, you and I are around long enough to remember when waterfall was all the rage. And you would do all the development, and then at the end, when everything is done, okay, now we'll apply the authentication and the authorization and the encryption. But what we see now is that's there are things that are being addressed earlier in, as an example, earlier in the data solution delivery process. And that ties in, for example, with pillar 5 of the True Data Ops philosophy, or 6 as well, in terms of, you know, how are we going to handle data quality management? All these, what we also call non-functional requirements, but basically the governance components. So I'm seeing a lot more of momentum towards shift left. I'm seeing a lot more awareness around governance aspects, like, you know, trustworthy data, like scalability earlier in the life cycle. And yeah, there would be a level. I mean, another one, just in terms of the pillars, again, versioning of data, right? That's becoming more of a thing, because if you look at the data ops mindset, you know, pillar 2, we want to, you know, around CI/CD and really an orchestration, and we want to have all of our dependencies for our solution in one branch if we can help it. And that includes the data. So I'm also seeing more momentum and activity in terms of versioning of data as part of a broader data solution, a data ops type solution.
Yeah. So that's, I guess that's part of the evolution where, you know, when we started this journey on the True Data Ops side, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, the best we could get out of people was it's DevOps for data. But now it's like, yeah, it's a little more than DevOps, like you said, right? Trying to version the data is way different than branching and merging code, right?
Yeah, indeed. And I would go a bit further there. I mean, DevOps for data is probably, if somebody is new to data ops, it's probably a way to open the door for them into the conversation. But, and also like DevOps, data ops is a culture, okay? So when DevOps came on the scene, it was about encouraging developers to work more actively and interactively with operations and testers. I mean, DevOps should probably actually be called Dev Test Ops, but that's another conversation. But bringing in BA, business analysts, into the conversation. And it's the same approach for data ops, where the data engineer works interactively and iteratively with the test function, with the production, the operational aspects around, I mean, pillar 6 of the philosophy around monitoring, for example. So it's an ecosystem. So, and first and foremost, I would classify it as a culture.
Yeah, because it's a different way of approaching it, whether, again, like you mentioned before, whether we're talking about calling them data products or if we're still just talking about building a data warehouse, it's the approach, and it's different than, well, it's an evolution really from, I think, Agile, when we were all trying to apply Agile to data warehousing. Mm. And this is another step beyond that even.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever I'm lecturing in data management, you know, there's a lot of areas to cover, but there's two key areas that I always make a point of mentioning. And the first one is, it's partially why data ops came into being, and the separation of workloads. I mean, if you were new to data, you might think, but why don't we do all of our operational work and our analytical work in the same place? And obviously, you know, it's an old story now, but a lot of people aren't aware of it anymore, is the fact that there was a reason to separate. And that's why data warehouses became a thing, and data mesh as a response to that, and data lakes in the middle. So it's a separation of those workloads of the operational OLTP, online transactional processing, like a patient management system in a hospital. And then on the other side of the spectrum, it's looking for patterns, looking for insights across a large data set. Okay, so separating those workloads out. And one key component of that is data pipelines, data ops related things like data products, okay? And another thing that I always mention to the students is, and this is something it's referred to in the data ops philosophy, is that data has state. I mean, it's an easy thing to say, data has state, but it's so important, because if we change in the context of in comparison to code, right, we can code, it may or may not have an impact. If we change data, that's depending on if versioning of data and backups and whatever else. But if you drop a piece of code from a script, it may not affect it if you drop a column. So data having state, I think, is very important as the background concept of why data ops is there an industry, why it's needed.
So with the advent now of AI and Gen AI, and it's, you know, gaining so much momentum in the industry, do you think that these the pillars and the philosophy here at True Data Ops are more or less important than they were before?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll answer this based on three things: what I see in industry, what I see with my clients, and I recently completed a diploma in safe AI governance and adoption at University College Dublin. So what I see is, right, actually, here's an example, Kent. The latest buzzword is vibe coding. Heard about vibe coding? Vibe coding. No. Yeah, enthusiasts will type into one of the chatbots, like ChatGPT or Gemini or Anthropic's Claude, and say, right, give me a dashboard, or give me code to create a data pipeline, or whatever it is. And it will do that. But we don't know if that the typical vibe coder, unless they already understand coding like SQL or C# or Java or whatever it is, how do they know if it's actually correct or not? Or more specifically, in terms of the pillars, pillar three, okay? Component design and maintainability, because the vibe coding could lead to a 500 line script, whereas optimal coding, like following, it's brilliant that the data ops philosophy actually ties in Eric Raymond's Unix philosophy and best practices. And that's where I'm going with this, right? So we could have a vibe coder who generates 500 lines of Python or whatever it is code, where that could have been done in maybe 50 lines, and that vibe coder will never know. So when it comes to maintaining that code, it's like, that's 10 times as much code to maintain, right? So that's one thing I see that's in terms of the pillars, that's really important. So we bring it back to pillar number three, component design and maintainability. I think it's never been more important, and for the reason I've mentioned. Another thing I see is around governance. I mean, there's an acronym, Kent, that you've used on the show in the past, PPD, PP, people, processes, technology, right? And data.
Yep.
So, right, when we talk about AI, typically the automatic thinking process is tech, which is correct, right? AI is a very technical orientated component. However, to have successful AI adoption, we need to think about the people aspect, like AI literacy around training, like trustworthy AI. And straight away, we're getting into, as I mentioned, governance around pillar five. monitoring of data around pillar six and knowing, is our data trustworthy? Is the data that we use trustworthy? Is the data that we use to train our AI trustworthy? Because that obviously has a knock-on effect. One of the, you know, regulation processes being rolled out at the moment in the EU is the EU AI Act. And Article 10, what's it all about? The management of the quality of the data sets in relation to the training of AI, right? So back again to pillar 5, pillar 6, and dare I say pillar 7, when we talk about anonymization and things like that. So it's the data ops approach, if the true data ops approach is as relevant as it's ever been, and I would say more important than it's ever been.
Yeah, because now we're trying to do even more with the data than we did before. So yeah, I am particularly have been concerned all along about the things you mentioned, governance, security in particular, but then yeah, the trustworthiness of the data. And that brings us back to the automated regression testing and monitoring. You know, are we, mm-hmm. you know, how do we make sure that the data we're feeding into an algorithm is the type and quality that we expected, especially when you're going and into a production ecosystem or a production pipeline where we've gone from dev and it's all theoretical and all of this to now we're, you know, moving what we think is good production quality data in, that we still need to be doing the monitoring then. It's probably more so really in the production realm where you may be, you know, expecting outcomes from the AI that are going to help run your business. And especially you mentioned healthcare, right. I would assume, you know, that's like literally mission critical. And, you know, we used to joke, well, data warehousing isn't really life or death. If the data warehouse goes down, it's not such a big deal. But now we're talking about driving outcomes in healthcare using AI. So now it might end up legitimately being life and death. And so this becomes, I think, even more important probably than it was, you know, 5 years ago when we first started talking about all these things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's different considerations, for example, where the AI is used and, you know, whether it's generative AI or something else. So if it's used in medical devices, which is really regulated anyway, that's the kind of risk that you referred to. If it's just being used in terms of, you know, just a chatbot or something like that, the risk drops. But the risk is still very relevant and has to be kept in mind exactly in line with what you mentioned. Yeah.
Because certainly even with a chatbot, if somebody is on a medical chatbot asking a question about some symptom they have, you know, you want to get the right response of, yeah, you need to call a doctor. Right. You need to call a real doctor right now, or you need to go to the emergency room. That it's, yeah. Well, versus, absolutely. Yeah, take two aspirin and chat with me in the morning.
Absolutely. Yeah, and this is the other risk. Okay. Just for out of curiosity, I was using one of the chatbots. It was ChatGPT. And I was checking to see, I think you kind of need to know the answer actually already to know if the chatbot is accurate or not.
Right.
Or have a way to verify it, because otherwise, right? And I was just checking I said, what are the attributes for an integration platform as a service? I already knew the answer, but I wanted to see what it would say. It gave me 10 characteristics. The first 8 were accurate, okay? The first 8 characteristics of this question, the response were accurate. Number 9 was actually a duplicate of one of the other ones, the previous ones. And number 10 was completely left of field. It was nothing to do with it at all, okay? With the question of, you know, what does an integration platform as a service, what are the characteristics? So because I already knew the answer, I was able to say, oh yeah, there we have a hallucination. But if someone like you mentioned there is, you know, using a chatbot for, depending on the level of the decision, how can they know if the answer is correct or not? They either already need to know, have a good idea of what the answer should be, or have a way of verifying it. So that's, and that all ties back again to what was the AI trained on? What was the data governance? Is there bias in the data? You know, the variety of data sets that were brought in. The conversation now could go in lots of different directions, like interoperability in terms of data products. But yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. So with all the changes and things that have happened in the industry in the last, you know, 5-6 years, do you think there are any changes that need to be made to the seven pillars? Did we miss something? Does something need to be updated? You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Well, going back to pillar three, so component design and maintainability, it states in within the content, and it's accurate, okay? It's correct that developers want to be held back by having to optimize their code early on in the process, okay? You know, doing performance optimization too early may not give you a good return on investment. However, there are exceptions to that that would be worth taking into account. And I'll give you an example, Kent, that you'll already know when I... So let's say we're processing 10 rows. If we do it row by row by row, doesn't matter. If we're processing 1 million rows, then things like how we process it becomes important, like set-based, right? Set-based processing,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Using SQL, where we can, in one database transaction, process 1 million rows, versus if we do it row by row, we process, we need a 1 million transactions, which is a much less optimal approach, right? So where I'm going with this, Kent, in terms of pillar three is something along the lines of, right, continuing with the position that a developer prioritizing performance management is not optimal. However, a developer, engineer, or whoever, whatever the role, because it will take the same amount of time to code row by row processing versus set-based. Actually, this is the real, ideally a data engineer should know, okay, well, if I code it this way, that's optimal versus coding it this way, which takes about the same amount of time, that's going to be less optimal. So probably a bit more nuanced in terms of pillar three. So it builds on what's there. That's yeah. One suggestion. Another suggestion would be introduce the term framework, right? I haven't seen it in the content, but you know, we talk about approach, we talk about philosophy, which is accurate. It's also a framework. And what's a framework? It's something that we can build a system or a concept around, like literally a frame of a window or something, right? So if we look at the pillars, they're all part of a framework. What do we need to consider when we're looking at data solution delivery, data product delivery, or whatever it might be? What's like a checklist, or what do we want to build on? So it's actually a framework as well. And if we position it as a framework, then it can open other doors in terms of other places that it can benefit from. And I'll just give you an architectural example. The true data ops framework now, the philosophy anyway, would plug right into TOGAF. So TOGAF, the Open Group Architectural Framework. And that's just an example. So in terms of interoperability with other approaches and so on, that's another thought. I could go on, Kent, but I'm just, I know we're conscious on time here. Yeah.
Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it. And I know you've got some other thoughts on this. If you wouldn't mind, you know, writing that up, and you know, feel free to post it, or just send it over to us, and
yeah,
I'll collaborate with Guy and some others, and make sure that they get the feedback, because that's good. Things have changed a lot, and so there's definitely some places where we can go deeper, and like you say, we need to be a little more, we could be more nuanced with regards to certain aspects of it, of the seven pillars now. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as you said, we're kind of running out of time here. So what's coming up for you next? You know, meetups or things that where folks can find you, events you're speaking at, what's happening?
So what's happening, Kent, is, well, if folks want to get in contact, my website, galavan.com, that's G-A-L-A-V-A-N.com, or they can contact me on LinkedIn. One of my main focuses at the moment, Kent, is in terms of there's obviously a lot of geopolitical change at present. And one of the things I'm focused on is, well, how can I help my clients to navigate that? Whether it's regulatory compliance from a data perspective, like the EU AI Act I mentioned around Article 10 and data governance, like cross-border data exchange. So that's one of my areas of focus. There's other areas as well, like where can clients get data from other parts of an organization or from a marketplace? The value of data has never been more important. I'm talking good data. Most importantly, Kent, competitive swimming contest coming up. So that's sea swimming. You know, I live near the coast. The water temperature right now in Ireland is 11 degrees. Yeah, exactly. It's 11 degrees.
That's
Celsius,
11 degrees Kent, Celsius.
51 degrees okay. Fahrenheit. Yeah.
Yeah, the water temperature here in Galveston is now up to 73.
Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good. So there's a really good swimming spot, Kent, in Dublin called the 40 Foot, right? And it's actually, there's an Apple TV series called Bad Sisters, and it's featured, the 40 Foot, this swimming spot, is featured in that TV series. But basically, the next time you're in Dublin, Kent, let me know. I'll take you down to the 40 Foot.
Okay. All right. That'll be like swimming where I grew up in northern New York, up in Lake Ontario, and in the Adirondack Mountains, where it's the water never warms up there. Well,
so that tells me you're ready. You're ready.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a while. Well, thank you for joining me today, Dan, and for sharing your insights with us. I thank everyone for joining us online. Please be sure to join me again in 2 weeks. We're going to have a surprise guest in 2 weeks. So you stay tuned over the next 2 weeks as we announce who's going to be joining me for the next podcast. And as always, be sure to like the replays from today's show and tell your friends about the True Data Ops podcast. And don't forget to go to truedataops.org and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. So until next time, this is Kent Graziano, the Data Warrior, signing off. Ciao.